Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine the state of labor in America with a labor organizer and educator and an historian of American labor. First, we will speak with Les Leopold, who directs the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute and is a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations like the Sierra Club and the United Steelworkers Union. Then, to get a sense of where the labor movement stands today in comparison to its strength and percentage of the workforce that was unionized in previous decades, we will speak with Leon Fink, who edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. We will discuss what might revive the labor movement and restore the American dream as the current recession deepens and jobs, or the lack of them, become grist for the political mill in the upcoming election year. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us is Les Leopold, who co-founded and directs two nonprofit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. He also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which involves United Steelworkers Unions and the Sierra Club and other unions and environmental organizations. He's the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Les Leopold.
Thank you for having me.
And happy Labor Day to you, Les.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to be happy on this Labor Day if you're interested in labor.
And why is that?
Well, we have the highest unemployment rate since 1937. We've got longest sustained unemployment rate since 1937. We had no job growth for the first time in the post-World War period. It's tough to be a working person in this environment, and unions are suffering even more in a way.
Well, I've talked to labor historians and others who have analyzed the situation, and I've been getting a lot of email from real union guys, the people that are in the trenches, saying, you know, why are you talking to academics who've got tenure and job security? Why don't you talk to people out there on the front line? So give us a flavor of that, Les, because I feel like I've been called out here.
Well, I you need both. You need to know what's going on now, and you need some perspective. But I think this is clearly the worst time for unions since the modern labor movement was formed. I mean, the labor density is now in the private sector is probably falling below 7%, maybe even below 6%. You see public sector workers being attacked from all sides. You have perhaps the biggest problem is you have a defective political strategy and one that it seems impossible almost for labor to rearrange. For 50 years, labor has been counting on the Democratic Party to be the party of jobs. And it no longer is. And, there's some good Democrats who care about these things. But basically, the Democratic Party, I'm going to quote somebody else here, but it's a very good phrase, is trying to be a party both of the predators and the prey. And that doesn't work. What you have, however, is that the labor movement is going to double down once again on the Democratic Party. No matter what happens, no matter how badly they get screwed, they're stuck inside the Democratic Party because the Republicans just seem so much worse, and they can't figure out how to break away politically. And that, I believe, is the biggest crisis that labor unions have ever faced. There's other problems as well, which is in order to have a mass base, it seems to me that unions have to rethink who they are. I think the efforts of some to begin to get green in a hurry is a step in the right direction, because I think we have to speak to the entire person, the entire community, and employment in sustainable green jobs is, I think, what everybody wants, and the sooner unions can speak that language, the better.
Well, you know, that didn't happen when the first piece of legislation that the president managed to get through when he had that honeymoon period when he first came in, of course, was the stimulus bill, And a lot of critics in retrospect, and at the time, as a matter of fact, said it wasn't enough, that he got had and taken by the Republicans, who said that they'd support it if you converted 40% of it to tax breaks as opposed to cash. And of course, not one Republican voted for it. But the main critique in retrospect has been that that shovel ready, by its very nature, was the old economy that had some of that money gone. And I believe some of it did go to green insulation and some research. But of course, sadly, the biggest solar company up here in the United States just went bankrupt or filed for bankruptcy after receiving government loans, which of course the Republicans are going to jump all over. Do you think this White House has shown some leadership or sufficient leadership on this point?
No, and I think the missing factor was that the Democrats and Obama, I assume he's a Democrat, should have made jobs their number one and only goal from the second he came into the White House. See, he accepted the Larry Summers and the Tim Geithner argument that unemployment was going to fall as soon as the banking system was resurrected. So therefore, the bailouts of the financial system, and not being too hard on them, they told him to shut up with his rhetoric about his populist rhetoric, and jobs would be would flow again once money flowed properly through the financial system. Now it's true things could have gotten worse if the financial system didn't get put back together, but it did not trickle down into jobs. So how would it look if you really cared about jobs? What you would do is say, I'm putting people back to work. We have to rebuild America's infrastructure, so we're going to rebuild it, and we're going to subsidize state and local governments indefinitely, so they don't have to lay off any people, and we're going to make them hire more people, and we're going to make the private sector hire more people. We're going to do whatever we can do. We're going to do whatever it takes, not just what we can do, but whatever it takes to put people back to work, and then measure yourself by that standard. Instead, what's happened is they've given up the narrative to the Republicans in a disastrous way. 2 years ago, when you interviewed me, I think it was pretty clear to most Americans that the problem of the economy was too much money in the hands of a few, which turned Wall Street into a casino and turned the stock market in general into a giant casino, the housing market into a giant casino, which crashed. Lack of regulation, too much money in the hands of a few, bad tax policy on the rich, and so on. That it was clearly a Wall Street-induced economic crisis. But now the narrative has changed in a terrible way. Now the narrative is, We're living beyond our means. We have too much debt, and only once we cut enough debt will we be able to get the economy going again. The narrative now is that public sector jobs suck, and the only good jobs are private sector jobs. So let's whittle down the public sector and get the regulations off the private sector so they can grow again. This is an utter fabrication of what happened. It's a total lie, and President Obama maybe couldn't have done all the things I just suggested. But he could have tried, and he could have kept the narrative clear that the problem is Wall Street gambled our economy into the ground, and we have to put people back to work. He could have kept the focus on that. Instead, he drifted into this debt garb. Well, first of all, he lost the Congress because he didn't keep his eye. He went for health care instead of going for jobs. That was a big mistake, I think. He spent his political capital, little that he had, and they're not being kind to him on that front for sure, on health care. And as important as that is, that's a badly compromised piece of legislation. Putting people back to the work always comes first. And he didn't feel that sense of urgency of now. He missed the now. The Republicans came in with their Tea Party people who were furious at this, that, and the other. And people who are unemployed and concerned didn't know where to turn. And they rejected a lot of the Democratic leadership because they didn't see it anymore as a party of jobs. Anyway, my point is this. The narrative has to be about jobs, not about debt. And it has to be about what really crashed the economy. Look, in 6 months, 8 million jobs disappeared when the financial crisis took place. That was not a problem of debt. We didn't have a debt problem then. We didn't have a state and local fiscal crisis problem then. We had it only after those jobs were lost. So focusing on that is the task of the Democratic Party. It's going to be very difficult for them to recapture it. And on some level, I'm not sure Obama truly at a gut level feels it. He doesn't feel it enough, to be convincing. He's going to have to feel it a lot in the next 2 years, or he's going to be out in the street. And we're going to be stuck with these, you know, Republican Neanderthals who are going to talk all about that, and they're going to drive us back to the verge of a Great Depression. That's what their stuff's going to do to us.
Again, I'm speaking with labor organizer Les Leopold, who serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which involves trade unions and environmental organizations such as the United Steelworkers Union and the Sierra Club. He is also the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. And in terms of a Labor Day discussion here, Les, obviously one hates to be pessimistic and bleak here. And of course, the statistics make that pretty inescapable. As you mentioned, organized labor is down to about 7 to 6% of the private workforce at the moment. This jobs speech coming up on Thursday had to be rescheduled. Why the White House chose it on the same day that the Republican debate has done nothing but make one question the strategy there at the White House, since they again looked like they've been hosed. What's your expectation? I mean, obviously a speech alone is not going to change the labor landscape.
Well, one way to measure it is if you go to the Blue-Green Alliance website, there's a Jobs 21 platform there about how to create a very detailed description of it that they put together on how to create 10 million jobs. New jobs. He needs something on that scale. And the way to measure him would be, is he going to come up with a plan that can create, you know, 8 or 10 million jobs over the next 3 or 4 years? Or is it going to be piffle, you know, lots of little twist here, a little twist there? He's going to have to be, I don't know what to expect, but he's going to have to show some real outrage. And he's going to have to lead. He's going to have to push. He can't start by compromising. But the problem is, I mean, now we're talking not about Labor Day, but the strategy, the White House strategy is to look reasonable, to keep moving to the center and make the Republicans look unreasonable, and they'll look reasonable and they'll win. But, you know, that's nice game theory. But with, you know, something like 29 million people unemployed or underemployed at the moment, those people don't care about game theory. They don't care about who looks right. They care about getting back to work. So he's got to have to show some real moral outrage. He can do it. The question is whether he will. We'll find out soon enough. But it's in a way, it's pathetic that the Democratic leadership and President Obama have waited this long to talk about to hammer in on a jobs crisis. Why did they talk about debt for the last year? Why bother? Why not be talking about jobs all the time? Why not from the first day you're in office when you have so many jobs disappearing? It's interesting. History can repeat itself. Unfortunately, one part of it's not repeating itself. The part that's repeating itself is that there was actually because Roosevelt was so aggressive in the 1930s when he came into office with job creation programs and public spending, there was a recovery, but they mistook the scale of the recovery. And in 36, 37, they cut back on spending and tried to balance the budget, and sure enough, it's unemployment shot through the roof again. So we haven't learned from that lesson. We're doing it right now. We may be in a recession already. The part that unfortunately is not happening is the labor resurgence that went along in the 1930s. You know, there are some bright spots now. There are some unions that are, you have the California nurses attacking their national union attacking Wall Street and trying to do rallies and take people to the street. And you have a lot of anger on the steelworkers. They want to fight. They want to do something. But until there needs to be sort of a symbiotic attack on jobs coming from the Democratic Party, the president, and the labor movement, and the environmental movement for that matter. Unfortunately, this is the worst Labor Day ever, because things are drifting so quickly to the right. The whole fundamental dialogue is switching to the right. The memory of what caused the crisis is leaving us. We're getting what I call financial amnesia. We're forgetting how we got here, and we're buying this, debt is bad, kind of, government debt is bad, arguing the public sector is bad, and the voices who could do something about it are silent. In fact, they're, you know, giving in. So anybody that has a job right now is listening, you know, we should be thankful. And also we should be thankful there's still some unions around that exist and that are fighting. But there's going to have to be a whole lot more done, especially in the political arena. And at some point, we have to wean ourselves from a strategy that says no matter what Democrat is running, we got to support him. Because the rank and file is not going to buy that. They're going to protest. And we're not giving them an alternative. I don't know what that alternative looks like in our current environment, but the Tea Party just proved to us that you could have a very strong formation inside another party and really make a difference. How come there's not a jobs party inside the Democratic Party that's hammering away on these people that are trying to kiss the butts of Wall Street, that are still refuse? I mean, they still can't. Even when we had Democratic majorities in both houses, we could not pass a simple tax reform that would have hedge fund billionaires pay the same income taxes as everybody else instead of giving them their carried interest maximum 15% around. They make billions of dollars. And we don't have the courage to tax them. The Democrats couldn't pull that off when they controlled both houses. So, you know, people are going to be are looking for leadership, looking for some people, somebody to say it like it is, a party that says it like it is, or a group within a party to say it like it is, and threaten to take them down if they don't come around. And what's going to happen anyway is, as I said just a second ago, I think the rank and file, some will go along with the leadership and support the Democrats no matter what, but a lot are going to rebel. And since they don't have a choice, the Republicans are going to be the benefit of that rebellion, or they're going to stay home. And that's a sad state of affairs. I'd like to say something really positive. You know, I could give you all the rah-rah stuff about, you know, there have been some great strikes that have been fought, and there have been some, you know, labor board victories, and there have been some nice coalitions that are forming between labor and environment, but we have so far to go because when the whole glacial we're having like a right-wing continental drift that's accelerating. It's just moving, like an ice floe, moving to the right, to the right, to the right. And the whole dialogue is moving to the right. That is more dangerous than anything else that's going on. I don't see anything to stop it right now.
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, I imagine. Again, I'm speaking with labor organizer Les Leopold. Clearly, the foxification of news, the fact that there's no progressive alternative news network in this country, not the least of which would be just a basic kind of BBC news network that is neutral, but it provides real information as opposed to propaganda for the Republican Party. And, the Republicans, as you say, have captured the debate. A small group of radicals have captured the Republican Party and captured the national agenda. There's nothing happening much on the left. And in fact, if anything happens on the left, it's going to be probably a primary challenge to Obama, which is going to damage him further and make it more easier for the Republicans to take the next. They're in a good shape to take the Senate, just numerically, but they could take back the White House and have the whole trifecta. And if you had a Perry in the White House, the entire country would become a right-to-work state, wouldn't it? I mean, isn't that... That's the part of it I'd like to ask.
It's easy to talk. It's not so easy to govern.
Right, but the damage would be done if he gets elected, won't it? Or if all of these guys get elected.
I'm not supporting any of the yahoos that are running, but I don't think the average worker thinks it's going to get much worse. And I think it's very difficult to implement a right-wing agenda without taking the economy into a death spiral. So I think they're going to have some real problems in governing if they stick to their fantasy ideology. I mean, look, if you have a fantasy conception of what happened to the U.S. economy and where it ought to go, you're gonna make some enormous mistakes. The problem is that just happened with Bush, and you talk about the media, and I agree with you completely. But you know what? President Obama gets all the media he wants. He had something to say. If he actually said, "Look, I'm going to concentrate on unemployment, and I'm really not going to concentrate on Wall Street. They're not my priority." Had he told his advisors, "I don't want to hear that. I'm going to get on TV and say we got to put America back to work. I'm going to say it 1,000 times." Then the media would have to listen to him. But he gave the debate to the Republicans. He handed it over to them on a silver platter. First, with his very compromised health care plan. Second, with his incredible faith that his pro-Wall Street advisors, people made millions on, or lived with the people that made millions on, Wall Street, were going to bail him out of this crisis. And then and then turning over the debate entirely to the Republicans, agreeing with them that the debt crisis was the problem, and turning the whole country's focus that way, he dug himself a hole. It'll take, maybe he is a political Houdini and get himself out of it, but I'm very disappointed with his failure to do just what you said, which is public education. If all the public's getting is kind of right-wing media, it's a disaster. But the president has the power. He can do the bully pulpit. That's the one thing he has that's unadulterated, that nobody can stop him. He just has to call a press conference and start talking. And when the other side attacks, he talks some more. You know, someone pointed out that, the fire in the belly that FDR had, his, vehement distrust and dislike of the financial establishment was so palpable. American people trust them. You know what? Obama doesn't have that, not because he's a bad person, but he really doesn't think that's the real problem. And that's the astounding part. And labor has not found a way to get his attention.
Let me ask you again. I'm speaking with Leslie Appold, a labor educator who's brought together, worked on the Blue-Green Alliance, which involves unions and environmental organizations such as the United Steelworkers Union and the Sierra Club. The president, of course, has already inflamed labor by, or at least the Democratic Party and the Democratic establishment, by choosing North Carolina for their next convention. And apparently there are virtually no union hotels down there, which has infuriated the AFL-CIO. Is that an indication that the Democratic Party, because labor unions don't have the money they used to have and the influence they used to have, is simply going to where the money is, which is...
No, actually, I think labor still has quite a bit of money. That's not the issue. The issue is they got nobody else to give it to. So the Democrats can push them as far to the right as they want to, and labor will not say anything. Now, if they held a counter convention or didn't, or showed, chose not to show up, they might get their attention. But they're unwilling to. I guess they've gotten to the. I've never been able to figure this out. But they want to be an insider. They cherish their access to the White House, to to staff, et cetera, et cetera. And they just, even when the whole thing is flying to the right, they just can't stop and do anything bold enough to get their attention, because they're afraid they'll be cut off. There were, I was involved in education around the healthcare bill, and during one of the pieces of education that we developed with the Communication Workers of America was the difference between McCain's position and Obama's position on taxing healthcare benefits. Now, the Communication Workers of America have a very good healthcare plan compared to the rest of us, something they fought for over 40 years. Piece by piece by piece, and to tax it would be like a huge wage cut for them. Obama said he wouldn't tax them, and McCain said he would. And as soon as Obama got in, he agreed on a compromise to tax them. Now, not all at once; it takes some time, et cetera, et cetera. But he caved on that issue, and labor wouldn't. They negotiated with him, but they couldn't get him to back off of that. Now, had they said, okay, guess what, we're going to submarine the entire healthcare bill, screw you, they would have got his attention. But they don't want to do that kind of stuff. Look, he's a nice guy. He's incredibly smart. I'm sure, he's an incredibly decent person. But he's not progressive. He feels most comfortable in the middle of the road. And that middle of the road is shifting quickly to the right, and Obama's going right along with it. And labor's not stopping them. And that's the Labor Day message is obviously we need many more Wisconsins. We need much more defiant leadership. We need labor spokespeople that are going to organize this kind of charge. And somehow people smarter than me are going to have to figure out a political strategy that makes some sense to the rank and file, because we're losing them. They're going to vote, are going to sit home, or they're going to vote for Republicans, because we're not giving them anything to vote for in most districts around the country.
Well, just in closing, Leslie Apold, that, of course, is the key to the Republicans. They never get elected unless they get Democrats to vote for them. That is the
amazing, isn't it?
That's the so-called Reagan-Democrat phenomenon. So what is it, just in closing, what is it about that appeal that Rick Perry, he may be a Yahoo, but, you know, all the South is a right-to-work state. Working people down there seem to drink that Kool-Aid, that it's okay not to have a union. You know, that's a plantation mentality, whatever it is. I'm mystified by it. Can you explain to me?
I think it all has to do with employment. Whoever delivers the job is going to get elected. And he has a narrative that says, Texas is a booming economy unlike the rest of the country. Follow me. And unless Obama upends that, which is going to be hard to do when you have 29 million unemployed and underemployed around the country, it's going to be very difficult for them to do it. But that's what's giving him his strength. Get rid of unions, cut back social spending, get rid of the whole New Deal. He wants to go all the way back to 1900, to the Gilded Age, and let the industrialists and the entrepreneurs put America back to work. That's his story. And really what we're having now is this great, you know, ideological battle. And people go for that if it produces jobs. Because the only way to survive in our society is you got to have work. You know, unless you got a trust fund, you got to have work. So that's incredibly appealing. And look, how long has it been? When's the last time you heard a Democrat really talk about jobs and employment? I mean, really talk about it in a way that speaks to the average working person. Yeah, there's some good congresspeople around the country that still do that. But, you know, people are pretty gun-shy in the Democratic Party, getting too friendly with working people. So the other side, the Reagan Democrat, sounds like he's going to be more successful. Reagan put people back to work. We had a boom under Bush. Yeah, got a little out of hand at the end. We got a near depression under Obama. It's Obama's depression now. Zero Obama, whatever they're going to call him now. Zero jobs Obama. It's a very, very tough situation. So, you know, Perry, it's not that he's a Yahoo. It's that he's got a story to tell. It happens to be a lie, but he has a story to tell. And look, it's been history of the world. It's been you put people to work, either through war or whatever, you can elect anybody, even Adolf Hitler. So, you know, Mussolini, Hitler rose to power when in a dysfunctional society he couldn't put his people back to work.
Well, we have, I'm afraid, ended.
Happy Labor Day.
Exactly. I was about to say, Les.
Sorry about that.
But I do thank you for joining
us. I don't want to BS your listening audience.
No, I get it. And in spite of all that, have a happy Labor Day.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot, Les.
Thank you, Dan.
Again, I've been speaking with Les Leopold, who is a labor educator. He directs two nonprofit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. And he also serves as a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations such as the United Steelworkers Union and the Sierra Club. He's also the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. So we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with a labor historian. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Leon Fink, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He is also edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Work and Community in the Nuevo New South, and his new book just out, Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leon Fink.
Happy to be with you again.
And a happy Labor Day to you.
Thank you. Same.
And in terms of where Labor stands now, the president this week is going to give a speech about jobs. Clearly, with 9.2% unemployment, the real figure is over 16% if you count people who've given up looking for work and those that are doing part-time jobs that don't really make it. It's a pretty bleak landscape in terms of labor. Where is there some hope on the horizon here? Because I don't want to depress people on this day when we should
be... While they're picnicking, that's right.
Well, also it, celebrating, and I think, you know, it's worth noting a lot of people probably don't have a historical sense of the achievements of labor. You know,
true.
Otherwise we'd be working, we wouldn't have a weekend. You know, labor are the people who bought you the weekend.
It does seem that... sometimes we only notice labor when we can't find it, when there's no jobs to be had. And so I suppose that the good news is that it is such a center of attention now, both in politics and communities. That is, the question of employment, the question of what role does the government have in relation to the workplace, the very tumult and in many places of the country, anger about the state of rights on the job, particularly union rights in the public sector, these do suggest something of a shift in the political mood. Although it's still not the dominant tone politically, but I think you know, whereas for many years over recent decades, we could say that labor, and particularly organized labor, was complacent and fat and sassy. I don't think that's the case. I think it's hurt, frustrated, and angry.
And what is the explanation for this right-to-work phenomenon, the extent to which the South has always basically shut out labor unions? I mean, to some extent, I guess, you've written about this in the Mire of Morganton, Work and Communities in the Nuevo New South. What explains that? Because that's clearly the appeal of Rick Perry, who's running for president as a Republican and may well get the nomination. And he may well be a formidable candidate because he's saying, you know, I'm bringing jobs. I'm the Texas job miracle guy. Whether or not the jobs are worth anything is beside the point. And when you don't have a job, you know,
to a limited extent, I think the giant sucking sound that Ross Perot was talking about is low-wage jobs going to places like Texas from other places. But I think that only works in a very limited fashion for specific industries that that don't choose to go abroad for this very same reason, which has happened to most of our manufacturing sector. And much of the so-called job boom in Texas is low-wage jobs of immigrant labor. It's been a population boom in Texas fueled by immigration, much of it undocumented, which, of course, is something that he doesn't want to talk about or have a remedy for.
Again, I'm speaking with Leon Fink, who edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. And on this Labor Day, we're talking about perhaps a renewal of labor. If the right wing can create this fiction known as the Tea Party and effectively use it as a political tool to organize and revive the right wing of the Republican Party and to, you know, capture the national agenda. Is there a possibility of something happening in a similar way where you have a kind of an umbrella group that's amorphous like the Tea Party And yet, you know, the various factions within the Tea Party, of course, on the right, they tend to cooperate with each other, whereas on the left, they tend to argue. But what are the chances of our previous guest mentioned, the Jobs Party or something along those lines?
Well, I think that if Obama can't hold together a winning coalition in 2012 under his umbrella, and I think until that moment, it doesn't look like, no one is likely to challenge him even in a symbolic way in the primaries. But if he loses, then I think there is going to be a lot of changes within this no party that we call the Democrats, because I think there are going to be some very strong, there'll definitely be populist and other currents on the left that will call for, on the one hand, new policies at the political level, but I think also within this coalition there will be more direct action at the labor front. As workers lose card check protection, if you can't have card check, which is the case now in Wisconsin with public sector workers, if you can't have card check, then you have to go back to another way of organizing people, which could prove more disruptive than the people who put in these provisions imagine. Because the only way you can organize is to prove that your organization means something, to prove that it makes a difference. And that's likely to ramp up militancy.
Explain that, if you will, to the audience, the card check provision.
Okay. Well, basically in collective bargaining, where unions are well established, a majority of workers, once organized, can put in their contracts that they'll have that the employer will take out their union dues from their wages, so that the employer starts to do the organizing, by a form of bureaucracy, basically. The money is funneled back into the union for its needs. If you, in some cases, as in these right-to-work states or in states with that are taking on the public unionism and making a lot of it illegitimate, the only way left then for unions or as organizations to sustain themselves, just like any other voluntary organization, is by going around and collecting dues. That means buttonholing people. That means personal contact, face-to-face organizing, which is likely only to be successful if that group is getting results. And the way you get results as a union is to stir up trouble. So I think that it's likely actually to create a less orderly workplace picture with uncertain results. But I think it's going to politicize the workplace in a way we haven't seen by effectively doing away with the more orderly but bureaucratic forms of industrial relations that we're used to.
So you think that Governor Scott Walker, when he took away collective bargaining, planned on that, or was
not at all? Because it helps him in some practical ways. It really does savage the political power of the unions in the sense that they won't have the same treasury to work with. But it will definitely reduce the numbers overall on paper for the unions. But much of that is a passive membership to begin with, and if you make unions sort of earn their bread and butter again by face-to-face organizing, I think that has multifold impact. It doesn't just go in one way. It doesn't just go towards weakness.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Leon Fink, who is the editor of the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. And he's the author of a number of books, including Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Working Community in the Nuevo New South, and his new book just out, Sweatshops of Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. Why don't we just take a brief station break here, Leon,
sure.
and we'll be back continuing the conversation in a moment.
Bottom don't lag behind. Bring me me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul, tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them all down.
Tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm speaking with Leon Fink. He's a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas, and his books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Work and Community in the Nuevo New South, and his new book, Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the present. And in terms of reviving labor before the scenario that you were talking about earlier suggests that if President Obama doesn't revive the coalition, and obviously he's going to probably he's already disillusioned a lot of the progressives, and I imagine he's going to disillusion the environmentalists by authorizing this tar sands pipeline, which I suspect will happen, given that he's already caved in on the Clean Air Act. So if he is defeated, I mean, and let me ask you this: is there anything that can be done in you know, reviving the progressive movement without the president leading? In other words, pushing him. Look, if the Tea Party can invade the Republican Party and capture it, why can't a bunch of angry progressives get together and capture the Democratic Party and capture the agenda and sweep out the Wall Streeters and force their political representatives to represent them?
Well, I think it's a learning process, Ian, that has yet to find its it's appropriate strategy. I think we saw masses of people in Wisconsin that virtually turned the state upside down, although then they sort of backpedaled into an electoral strategy that came close but didn't quite bring home the bacon in terms of the recall. It does show there's an angry crowd, political crowd out there, potentially potent at the political level. But I think we're still, in terms of strategy and tactics, have yet to find the appropriate one. I'm thinking of the movements that we've seen in other parts of the world, where whether it's the so-called Arab Spring or the movement of Anna Hazari in India, where one person can galvanize dramatic popular support with, in this case, nonviolent fast. We haven't seen from the ranks of labor any really imaginative street tactics, nonviolent mass protest, you know, for a long time, really since probably Cesar Chavez. We haven't had a powerful leader emerge, someone who's willing to go outside of bureaucratic constraints to really ask for popular support and to bring people out in any sustained way for years, really since the labor civil rights coalition.
So, you know, I hate to be a broken record here, but a part of my political understanding is that there's a kind of Pavlovian nature to politics, where there has to be sufficient pain before there's sufficient gain. In other words, when we really we are, I think, in a heading back into a double dip recession. But is it going to require a depression to galvanize the majority of people in this country to question the idea of the American dream,
tens of millions, 10 million plus out of work, that's a lot of people. They don't, what more of a depression do we need? I think what we lack so far is we don't have an unemployment movement. I mean, in the 30s, there were rent parties, there were refusals to allow evictions. We haven't come up with the strategy or tactics to touch the people who are suffering or to give them hope that there's a real alternative. And I think we often hear from the labor movement, from the progressives generally in this country, that labor rights are human rights. But until people believe that and are willing to act on those rights in the same way that they took seriously civil rights, something worth sacrificing for, something worth maybe going to jail for, then I don't think until that test has been made, we don't know what the potential is for a true popular response.
But Leon Fink, as a labor historian, how do you explain how quickly the country has changed? If you see President Roosevelt's State of the Union address in 1944, where he called for a second Bill of Rights, where he called for health care, job security, a living wage, called for the end of monopolies. I mean, it's an amazing, it's breathtaking,
yes,
to think that was on the agenda back then, and that wasn't so long ago. And now you have these people like Grover Norquist, funded by the Koch brothers and all of these other, bilious billionaires, talking about shrinking government down to the size you can drown it in a bathtub. And of course, that's a lie, because government got bigger under George W. Bush. But the truth of the matter is this is a form of right-wing welfare. What the Republicans do is they create a system of where you loot the government, where private public money is transferred into private hands. So
That's true, but haven't those people always been around in one form or another? Don't we have to expect that kind of message is going to be out there and that's even going to be well-funded? I think the question is what alternatives being posed to them. I mean, we can't shrink from the challenge of the right. I mean, they're willing to take the country back really before the progressive era, not only before the New Deal, but what's the alternative really being posed to them? I think part of the reason that there aren't maybe angry people in the streets or surrounding the White House is that we have had we have humanized capitalism in this country to a degree, and we do offer some fallback protection, shreds of a safe. There is something of a safety net and extended unemployment compensation in some of the welfare programs that the country has. But surely that's shredding in the past years, and surely that's inadequate for the needs of people as schools close, teachers are laid off, as people lose their housing. Surely there's tinder for another vision, a more energized response to the changing nature of global capitalism.
But what happened, though, to that enormous legacy and majority in that earlier generation, the one that is called the greatest generation, that supported this president who called for this second Bill of Rights, to call for stuff that other, by the way, other social democracies have? This would be a very different America today if those things were implemented, any of them for that matter,
I do agree, but I think that there in terms of what happened to the specific message, one of the things that did happen was the post-war boom, so that a lot of three decades of people generally doing pretty well, even without an expansive new programmatic vision, that is public policy. There was just a greater pie, and people ate it, got a piece of it. But then that pie froze or has been diminished, and we go back to the state of public programs, basically, as you're saying, at the end of the New Deal with a few tinkerings since. But there's been no gust of wind behind the backs of a more progressive social vision since that time.
So how do you explain then the fact that the progressive movement has its real victories since FDR have been the Civil Rights Act and in effect and the anti-war movement at the end of the Vietnam War. But it seems their successes seem to be at a cultural level, and all of that anti-war activity, as soon as Nixon ended the Vietnam War, that as a political movement, a powerful political movement, it just dissipated. So I don't understand how you...
Well, I think civil rights, the feminist movement, environmentalism, and there was a lot of unfinished business. The very nature of the workforce and the working class has dramatically changed, even since Jeff Cowie's 1970s. And not to mention the hammer blow that people have not figured out how to respond to of globalization, of the total transformation of the of production across the world. I just think it's partly taken time to catch up to these changes, but I don't think that people had totally fallen asleep, but I think that there has not been the same coalition can't carry the day now that carried it then. It has to be a new coalition, and it has to include, I mean, among the people who it has to include is an immigrant labor force, some of whom, unfortunately, don't have even the most basic political rights.
Well, wouldn't it seem, though, Leon Fink, that that we need a little bit of honesty here and less sort of jingoism and false patriotism and a real examination of the nature of the American dream, the nature of a social contract? What is our birthright here as Americans? Are we exceptional in any way? When right next door you have a country, Canada, that has a high standard of living, all kinds of benefits that they get for their tax dollars, and we have none of those. I mean, why not have a real examination of the American dream and do a real accounting of what it is, you know, what does it mean to be an American? Just cutting aside all of the patriotic jingoism and getting down to the nitty gritty and painting a real picture.
I think all for the good, Ian. I think that Americans, I'll give even the popular culture credit for being more cosmopolitan, despite, you know, some twinges of old style jingoism and xenophobia. But I think overall it's a more multicultural country and political culture. I think even the support for it's a more tolerant place than it has been before. I think it's ready to look for answers outside of our borders as well. I don't think that the fact that, you know, socialized medicine is Canadian or is French or German, I don't think those arguments play so well anymore. So I don't think that's really the problem, is that people are just falling, that the right can just fall back on an idiot Americanism. I don't see that quite as the problem.
Well, do you think that there is some traction in the idea of fairness and the disparity of wealth growing in this country, and the idea that billionaires, the Republican Party's gone to the mat for billionaires? For God's sake, please don't tax them anymore, even though they're doing better than ever, and that the poor have to maintain the burden of and deal with this debt. So the very people who ran up the debt and who the taxpayer then made whole through the TARP payoff now are immune from any social responsibility. They're sitting pretty, and the rest of us have to service this debt.
I just think people want something very tangible. I don't think it's that they're afraid of something radical, but it has to be something that they can see almost immediately having some positive effect. I mean, much of the Obama's health care benefits don't even take effect till 2014, so people don't even see the people who are covered by insurance don't even see that yet because they don't really have it yet. But the same way would have been, imagine if he'd moved dramatically at a crucial moment to nationalize the banks, as is in the case in France, and then used the government influence over banks to actually change mortgage policies to stave off this whole foreclosure crisis in a tangible way. I mean, that would make a difference. So would a jobs program that immediately puts, you know, potentially millions of people to work. I just don't see. I think there would be support for that, actually.
Well, there's evidence that one of the states with the best economy and the lowest unemployment, North Dakota, has a state bank, and that community banks seem to be the best way around Wall Street, and it's how banking used to be before the big banks took over and took all of that money that used to be recycled back into the community. Now it goes directly into their pockets and into speculation. Well, I thank you for joining us here.
Ian, it was a pleasure. Let's make Labor Day something memorable this time.
Well, I thank you for joining us, okay. Leon Fink.
Bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Leon Fink, who is a professor of history at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor in American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Working Community in the Nuevo New South, and his new book, Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.